Dr. Russell Taylor, you're the Transboundary Conservation Planning Advisor for the World Wildlife Fund. Is there anything new in the various resolutions adopted by the presidents of Botswana, Namibia, Zambia and Zimbabwe during the summit in Botswana?
There's a very strong desire, in particular two countries, Botswana and Zimbabwe, we have burgeoning elephant populations, of which some 60% of their range lies outside of protected areas, causing a huge amount of conflict with local people with whom they share the same space. And the tolerance of those people and developing coexistence strategies is terribly important if we're going to ensure these animals don't get illegally harvested and rather are part of an elephant economy that benefits local people and regional economies through tourism and so on.
The human-elephant conflict is posing a serious problem. The elephant population is growing and so is the human population. Conflict arises because of scarcity of resources. And the elephants do cause damage to crops, property and sometimes cost lives. Now, the population living in the immediate vicinity of the elephants is poor and coexistence with the elephants poses problems, Dr. Taylor.
They do indeed. A year's livelihood can be destroyed in one or two nights through crop raiding elephants, for example. That's one problem. The other problem is water tanks and reservoirs for livestock are being destroyed by elephants as well. And in the light of climate change, water resources are going to become increasingly more scarce. That's very evident right now in these drier countries. And people and elephants compete the same water resources. So there's a continuing and growing challenge there. So we've got to find alternative strategies to accommodate meeting the water requirements of elephants and other wildlife as well as those of people.
Do you see the human-elephant conflict worsening?
In many ways, Southern Africa's conservation success as far as elephants go is also now they've become victims of that success. Both the governments of the countries as well as the people of these countries. So that we have to deal with this, a burgeoning human population, a growing elephant population, and a scarcity of natural resources to accommodate both wildlife and people. So we're heading for a major conflict that is beginning to emerge now in the context of human-elephant conflict. So we've got to find solutions. If we don't provide legal alternatives to this problem of human-elephant conflict, people themselves will take matters into their own hands and they could themselves fuel the elephant poaching crisis. It's already on the increase in Southern Africa. And if we don't find coexistence measures for local people here, it would be very easy for them to become wound up by the poaching syndicates, the wildlife crumbs, and they take matters into their own hands. That we really have to avoid.
Given the resentment, to a certain extent, within the local communities, how do you engage them to work with the elephants and not against them?
The one thing that we have emphasized that we need to open up a dialogue, and we've got to find a common ground between understanding the needs of people who have to put up with the problems that elephants cause to those of us who in other parts of the world, in the north and the developed world, want to see elephants protected. And I think we've got to find a compromise to those different world views, if you like. Yes, people are very resentful of what has been happening lately, and things are reaching a crisis, particularly in Botswana right now, where it holds the largest population of elephants in the Khoza landscape. That's just around 130,000 odd, and then Zimbabwe with 82,000 odd is the next biggest population. So these two countries do have these conflictual situations which we have to address.
But how do you engage them? What do you say to them to quell their rancor or their fear?
Well, first of all, I think we need to return rights of access to natural resources to local people. And we use a term called community-based natural resource management. I think we've got to move beyond the days of being paternalistic, and we've got to give them real devolution where they themselves become their own responsible authorities, entitling them to benefit from natural resources, and they account to their own constituency rather than upwards to a higher level in central government, for example, which is what we've done for a long time. And community conservation is really about people through agreed systems of rules, and often this is their own rules, have access rights over land and other resources and are empowered to use, benefit, dispose of, or trade in those resources. And naturally, governments can provide a leadership role in helping that happen. And if I might just add, recent global biodiversity assessments have announced that, in fact, those areas that where biodiversity has been best conserved globally, that's around the world, is where there are local indigenous communities still there. It's not in the developed world that we've got our best biodiversity track records. It's where they're actually local people. And if we're looking towards a transformative process in a big landscape like CASA, which still has massive opportunities, still has, relatively speaking, low population densities, abundant wildlife populations, this is the place to allow transformation to take place and to really let people become masters of their own destiny, if I may use that expression.
Botswana's president, Masisi, gifted stools made from elephant feet to the presidents of Namibia, Zimbabwe and Zambia, who attended the Kasane Elephant Summit. The four presidents said they want to be able to trade and benefit from their own natural resources, in this case, the elephants. Russell, you can see their point of view. These countries need the funds and they are sitting on a gold mine, so to speak. As a conservationist with 40 years of experience in the field, how does that sit with you?
I'm comfortable that in the sense that provided it's done in a regulated way, it's done with good governance, and I think this is really important. It needs to be done within biologically sustainable limits, and hunting is embraced by some countries in the CASA landscape, not all, and I think Botswana wants to lift its current moratorium on hunting as a conservation tool, and I'd like to use that expression, a conservation tool, properly managed, properly regulated, using sustainable quotas. And when it comes to many animals, you're harvesting, in most cases, less than 1% of the population. It's what I might call part of wise conservation. If we are going to address the issues of conflict between people and wildlife and increasing their tolerance, as well as dealing with the issues of maintaining the full spectrum of biodiversity that we have in these landscapes.
So you think Botswana is going to go ahead and lift the hunting ban on elephants imposed in 2014?
I believe that will happen. It hasn't happened yet. It has been a very lengthy consultative process. What is called a social dialogue report has been issued that will lead, as I understand it, in this country to a white paper, which will go to Parliament, and it will be a parliamentary decision at the end of the day in a full democratic process.
Botswana said it won't apply culling to the growing elephant population, but it is considering cropping. What's the difference?
Cropping is a term that's used to harvesting wildlife populations for meat production in a sustainable way. It's like fishing. When we fish, we harvest, we use a biological term, maximum sustained yield, and you have it in fisheries, and you harvest what you think is a sustainable offtake. It's the same concept can be applied to cropping wildlife populations in a terrestrial environment, and that's not uncommon across many parts of the world.
There are five countries in the Kavango-Zambezi Transfrontier Conservation Area: Namibia, Angola, Zimbabwe, Zambia, and Botswana, with the largest elephant population. They have varying level of development and needs for their population. You, Dr. Taylor, argue it is better from a conservation point of view to harmonize policies and practices, but is that feasible?
I think in many ways it is. I think, as the communique mentioned, it recognizes the sovereignty of the five individual countries. It recognizes their different states of readiness to move into more overt management actions. And it recognizes the fact that there is an uneven distribution of, amongst other things, elephant in particular, across the landscape and across the five countries. So that said, there's still a great opportunity, for example, to harmonize things across borders in terms of allowing a greater movement of elephant in particular across borders. So if we could remove some of the barriers, such as veterinary control fences, which are a very huge impediment to wildlife movement right now, if we could overcome that problem, and there are means of doing that, which I could elaborate upon, then we could expect, we would like to see elephants increasingly moving from what I might call a locally overabundant situation in Botswana through Namibia into Zambia, into Angola, where both in Angola and Zambia, populations have been quite severely depleted by poaching. So one could expect through a harmonization of policy regarding law enforcement, for example, where the five countries garner their forces to deal with the poaching scourge, we remove that kind of barrier. We agree to see how offenses can be taken down to allow this greater movement of animals that could then repopulate these more depopulated areas as they are now. So that is a really an important area of real practical harmonization policy of that sort could work very effectively. So that's one example. I think there are others, of course, as well.
Dr. Russell Taylor, thank you.
Thank you very much.